farmers want to get on to Jai Furrow, if they email us, we'll give them details how they can get onto that particular site that Elaine's talking about. It is just unbelievable what he did cover, Elaine, so thank you for bringing that up. Now, Elaine, one question on this, and Antony, you want to say something, but one question is that when farmers want to go organic and they've got weeds like wild radish growing in the summer months, what do they do? They don't want to poison them. What do you think they should do?
They need to get out there with...
I'm talking about the wheat and the cereal grower type of farmers, the big farmers.
Right, and so they've got to get out there with a compost extract and push that ratio of fungi to bacteria to be way more fungal. They have to get the protozoa and the beneficial nematodes so they get the nutrient cycling that will select against very early weedy species like wild radish or any other of the early composite or, you know, the chickweed, the nut grass, nuts edge, all those problem grasses that we've got. So we've got to select against all of them. They all tend to require very bacterial dominated soils, no fungi at all.
Yeah, so we actually did it.
Please, can you just keep talking about this, Tony? Because we want to know what options they have in the cropping country where, as I explained, where you know, the soil's pretty dead and a few weeds come up. And
Well, we actually did what Elaine said about 3 or 4 years ago. We had a fat hen problem in a turnip paddock. So the farmer had planted the turnips and the fat hen came up with the turnips. And traditionally he would spray that out. And we said, well, why don't you do what we suggested, that, you know, we're looking to change the fungi to bacteria ratio. If you have the right ratio, that fat hen won't be the dominant species there, which it is now. So I said, why don't we do a little experiment? Let's go out, and we didn't actually charge him because we just did it as an experiment. Let's go out and put some compost extract on, and we'll do it. We'll do 2 or 3 hits. Let's just see how long it takes and what it takes to see if we can out-compete that fat hen. So he had a couple of paddocks that he left as a control, and he had a couple of paddocks that we hit with the extract. And I took photos, and we were able to get the fat hen to wilt and go a little bit yellow in the leaves. And it didn't actually die, but it got to the stage where the turnips were then able to outcompete the fat hen. And on the control, he had to spray it because the fat hen smothered out the turnips. So we actually, just through using an extract, we were actually able to change the biology in the soil enough to select towards the turnips rather than the fat hen. So, and I explained this to a DPI guy recently, and he said, can you send me the photos? He said, I'm aware of this, but I've never seen any data to show this. So I had the photos, so I sent them to him. So that's probably an example of what Elaine's been talking about.
Now, I'll just interrupt you two people again. Excuse me. guests, if you are on the line, just press *7 and come on. Don't wait for me to give you permission. Just start, come on the line. Now, while
we're
waiting for people...
Hello, Hugo.
Yes?
Yes, Roy McLean here. Hugo?
Roy.
Yeah, I just want to ask you a question of Elaine. When you're trying to build up your soil from a poor level, should you concentrate on the biological inputs or the mineral inputs like calcium or whatever?
What we've been finding, and again, this has been documented by that work by Jay Fuhrer here in the U.S., as you get the biology balanced properly, most of the chemicals come into balance because that's what life does, going to put, you know, make those nutrients in the proper forms. If you go out and put out mineral chemicals, they are all salts, and salt kills organisms. Once you get above about 100 kilograms per hectare, if you're putting out more fertilizer or more mineral than that, you're generally harming the organisms.
Well, it's
more
not
than
what
you're going to get.
Sorry, what you're saying is if you put it any more than 100 kilograms of any element, like with calcium or magnesium, whatever, that it would be acting like salts in the soil.
Yep, they are salts. All of those inorganic mineral forms that people use are indeed salts, and you're basically taking water away from all your microorganisms. Well, you take water away from you, what happens to you? You die. Same thing for the microorganisms in the soil. They're just way smaller than we are, so they can't tolerate being without water for a very long period of time. So the salts, whether it's calcium carbonate or it's magnesium sulfate or calcium sulfate, whatever mineral forms you're applying are probably doing a real negative. They're pushing you towards that very early successional, totally bacterial, nothing else left in your soil that then ends you up with a whole lot more weeds.
Just on that, Elaine, I think Graham Lancaster's done some work in this area. I can remember hearing him speak about if you can double your roots in your soil, then instead of, let's say, you needed 12 parts per million to grow this particular plant, you'd only need 6 parts per million. And
right.
if you triple your roots, then you only need like 3 parts per million. So suddenly a soil that we envisage as being depleted or lacking in a nutrient, we change the rules by doubling the root mass, which obviously we can do if we can lift the fungal biomass. And the other thing is if we can get mycorrhizal fungi in there, our ability to access that nutrient that is there, even if it is considered a depleted soil, changes again, doesn't it?
There's a lot of mechanisms by which biology and soil will access the nutrients that are in your sand, your silt, your clays, your pebbles, your rocks. You know, all of those contain these inorganic nutrients. And so when people say, when some fertilizer person says, you lack phosphorus in your soils in Australia, that's absolutely not true. You have plenty of phosphorus in almost all of the soils in Australia. You've got plenty of phosphorus. It's just not in a plant available form. And the only way to get that phosphorus into a plant available form is to have the biology. No biology, you're stuck using the inorganic fertilizers. So you want to put out biology once and have it start to work and develop and, you know, keep it alive and happy and it works for you for the rest of forever? Or do you want to have to be putting out inorganic fertilizers every year for the rest of your life?
Well, not much to get, Elaine. In a grazing situation, what would be the best thing to put out to raise your biological elements like mycorrhizae and fungi and that sort of thing?
Well, you'd probably want to put out a really good compost extract because basically when we're going out of pasture, a grazing system,
yeah, can you explain what a compost extract is then?
Okay, a compost extract is just going to use water, that bubbling, you have your tank, you're bubbling air into the bottom and you've got to have, you know, large enough air pump to get the amount of liquid that you're have in your tank to move and stay aerobic. You then just put in small amounts of compost and you let that movement of the water rip the organisms off the surface of the compost into the water. You're going to be getting some of the humic acids, the fulvic acids out of your compost as well, and that helps maintain this pretty normal background level of growth of the organisms in that extract. You don't have to be as crazy about maintaining oxygen because we're not adding any foods. See, in a tea, we would add foods to get the organisms to grow, to multiply, and increase in numbers. So if you have very, very little compost, you're going to have to make a tea to multiply the organisms, get it up. If you have, you know, 5 to 10 times as much compost than what you would need for a tea, then just extract it. Just put compost in, you know, like if you have a 500-liter tank You would put in a couple kilograms of compost, let it extract, and after 15 minutes, half an hour, look at the extract with a microscope. Do you have enough organisms? No. Put in another couple of kilograms of compost, let it extract for a few minutes, check again. And after that first run, you know how much of your compost you're going to have to use to get the organisms up to where you need them to be.
Right. Is the compost extract the same as the compost tea,
the compost tea, we're adding foods to get the organisms to grow. And the only time you would really need to make a compost tea is if you're going to have to stick those organisms onto the plant surfaces. Generally, you only need to be applying these organisms to the plant surfaces when you've got an outbreak of some pest or fungal disease or above ground foliar problem that you need to get the organisms back up to normal levels on the plant surfaces. Otherwise, be using extracts because what we need to fix is the soil. So maybe in the first year that you're doing this, maybe the first year or two, if you don't get the biology switched over right away, in the first year or two, you'll make both teas to put on the foliage in the springtime and then extracts to put onto the soil to fix the biology in the soil. But after that, you should only have to make extracts.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Tony, you might explain a little bit how you make the extracts or your what you've done with farmers as far as extracts go.
Yeah, well, we make an extract. We don't really make teas. We found that teas were fairly inconsistent, and it came back to, I think it comes back to hygiene. Although any time you start adding foods, as Elaine said, you're challenging your dissolved oxygen, and as soon as you lose or go under 6 parts per million, you become anaerobic, and the first thing that seems to die off is the fungi. We found with an extract that your product was a lot more consistent because whatever was in the compost was what was in the extract. With the tea, you're breeding up the biology that responds to the foods that you put in, and whereas with an extract, you're actually pulling out all the biology, not just the ones that would breed up, but other biology that might have bred up in a tea situation. So there's some benefits in an extract from that point of view. We like extracts. We can make large volumes relatively quickly, whereas with a tea you have to brew for a period of time, and that can be 24 hours or 48 hours depending on the system that you've got and the foods you're using. And the hygiene doesn't have to be quite as anal. You because you're not putting foods in, you're not creating anaerobic conditions. So we find the extracts really good for 99% of the work that we've been doing. There have been on very few occasions that we might have brewed a specific species, maybe Trichoderma, but really we really don't go there. But there are opportunities to do that on occasion where you brew something specific. Trichoderma being a predatory fungi.
Yeah, and that would only be if you've got some insane fungal plague that's wiping out your grapes or wiping out a particular problem. We can usually take down a fungal infestation like that pretty rapidly if we brew up some compost tea that's got a lot of added Trichoderma spores.
Yeah, and something like stripe rust can be a problem in cereal crops in southern Victoria, where we start to get a bit of moisture and a bit of warmth. And if that's an issue or a fungal disease like that on the leaf, then Trichoderma has a role to play. But generally speaking,
but
we don't go
there.
It
should be pretty rare. Yeah, you shouldn't have to do that very often. If you've got the biology in your soil right, won't happen.
We promote the fact that if we can put the tea on before you get any infestation, the idea is to give the plant protection rather than wait till it's nearly too late and try and save the plant afterwards. And we've done a lot of leaf analysis, and there are a lot of crops growing down this way which don't have much protection from leaf or airborne diseases. And so we encourage farmers to go out and put a compost tea over the leaves before it becomes an issue to give it protection. Yep.
Now you're talking about a compost tea, not an extract.
That's right. That would be, as Elaine said, that's when you use a tea because the tea is more active, therefore it can stick to the leaf surface. rather than extract, which is usually not as active. Yep.
Now, I'd just like to remind farmers who are in the line, just interrupt to start talking, because just press star 7 and let us know that you want to ask a question. Now, let's keep talking, Elaine. You've an absolute wealth of information. So just ask. We'll just keep going, eh?
I wanted to ask Roy if we answered his question fully.
What's that again, Elaine?
I wanted to know if we had answered your...
yeah, you did. Yeah, I said thank you a while ago. Okay. No, I was quite good. No, I was happy with that.
Great.
Yeah, Roy was at the seminar in August, Elaine, at Camperdown.
That's what I was.
Met you before. In fact, I think you got your jacket that you left there.
Yeah, I got it. Well, thanks, Tony.
No worries. probably something that we're working towards is a lot of these composts that we're making on the dairy farms are fairly bacterial dominated, because we're making them in relatively short time. We're turning with a compost turner, and one thing we're looking to do is then maybe sit the compost for a period of time and allow the fungi to move in and do its job as we've had the bacterial bloom settle down. And that's an area that we want to spend a bit more time on. And is there anything specific, Elaine, that you can suggest to assist farmers to move their compost towards being a bit more fungal dominant rather than being bacterial dominant? Because that seems to be the issue for most people making compost, is to move it towards being fungal dominant.
It's when you're storing your starting materials, especially anything that's woody or stocky, wide carbon and nitrogen ratios, paper, wood products of whatever kind, if you can inoculate those with just handfuls of fungal material, that when you're walking around on the farm and you see that those strands of fungi growing, take a little tiny handful and then go deposit that into your wood chip or your woody pile, sawdust, papers, whatever you've got. And that way we start to develop that fungal community in your starting materials before you ever put them into the pile. That really seems to help, having a really high fungal component already up and going before you ever start your compost. And
we're actually looking at the dairy farmers doing three types of compost on their farm, and I think that's the reason for doing that. We're looking at one pile being their waste management pile, and then do another one which is like the real woody material pile, which they don't put a lot of waste in, and that way it allows the fungi to proliferate in that pile. And then the opportunity is then to either use it as an inoculant as a starting brew for your new waste management pile the next year, or maybe shanding the two together when they go out and spread them. Is that something that you would encourage people to do?
Yeah, and I tend to think of it as, let's keep the three components of a good compost separate. So like your high nitrogen, if you've got alfalfa or clover or some other legume growing, harvest it, let it dry down, harvest it, cut it when it's green, like just after you pick your peas. Cut the pea plant itself, let it dry then, and store it dry, and it'll stay high nitrogen for you. So storage of these materials, of your greens and your high nitrogen, they should be dried down right away and stored dry where they don't ever get wet. Where is your wood chip pile? It should be out there, and just let it stay at typical moisture levels. You might want to cover it if it gets really dry. Cover it if you get rain downpour this year. You would want to left it covered all the time, because we had so much rain, so that it stays around 50% moisture, and the fungi just love that. Squishy, large, chunky materials for that woody pile. And then when you put your pile mix together, you're coming in with a really good fungal inoculum, and that tends to stick with you all the way through the decomposition process during composting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can at the end, you can try to add some additional fungal foods But, you know, what we're seeing is that just doesn't work very well. It's also really critical to make sure that your compost pile never goes anaerobic. At Rodale, we've had some piles over the last year that got left out, and they had like 6 feet of snow on top of them. Really had good fungal values before the snow fell. And then when that snow melted, we had 6 feet of water in that snow seep into the pile. They went totally waterlogged, wiped out all of our fungi. All of our good guy beneficial fungi were just gone. And so it was, you know, whatever compost we put out that in that springtime period this last year just wasn't up to snuff. And so we, you know, didn't see the benefits that we wanted to see from putting out compost because we just didn't have the fungi or protozoa or nematodes in that compost. Because although it was made properly and it was nice and aerobic, back at the end of the growing season, it got wiped out by the water melting, the snow melting, and totally saturating our piles and went anaerobic.
Do you find that in a circumstance like that, that the fungi goes back to a spore form, or is it lost? Do you have to re-inoculate that pile? How do you manage that windrow now?
The factor that's important is how fast did it go anaerobic, and how do you figure out that if you weren't there to pay attention to the fact the snow was melting and. Or, you know, you had a huge downpour and your compost pile is sitting in a puddle that's a foot deep or something.
Yeah.
If you're not there to pay attention, how do you now figure it out? Well, I would just let the pile dry down normally and monitor the fungi in that pile. So in those piles that got waterlogged, we monitored the fungi through the growing season. Finally, about halfway through the growing season, the fungi started coming back. So the fungi obviously went dormant. They made spores. The spores were hanging out. When conditions became ripe for those spores to germinate and grow, they did.
Yep.
And so we started getting that fungal component back. And then we had just some incredible rain. We had a hurricane go through, flooded the barn. It was a mess, and we didn't have time to pay attention to the compost, and we lost all our fungi again.
Okay.
So I'm hoping the fungi will come back, but if we would just store those piles undercover, these things wouldn't be happening.
Right.
But it's one of those many things, we'll get to it, and then Mother Nature sneaks up and smacks you from behind.
So there are obviously extremes in temperature in regards to rain and water. How about the other extremes of, in like a lot of farmers listening today don't necessarily have really wet conditions, so they might have really dry conditions. How does the fungi cope with that? Do we lose it, or does it just lie dormant?
And it's, again, a question of how fast you get dry. If the fungi have plenty of notice that it's starting to dry down, it's getting a little bit drier, okay, maybe we really need to go dormant. Then they're all in there in dormant stages, and as soon as you wet the pile back up, those spores will regerminate. They'll start to grow, and you know, within a month, maybe two, you can have the fungal component back again.
Yep.
It's when it dries down really fast that these organisms tend to die. They don't have time to make the dormant stages, and you'll never see them come back. So that's the thing to think about. Covering the pile is probably the easiest and best way to start to prevent some of those kinds of problems.
It'd stop the shock treatment, wouldn't it? It'll give them a chance to adjust to slowing down and going to dormant, wouldn't it, with a cover over it, yeah.
So cover it when it starts getting dry, cover it when it starts getting real wet, or if you live in a part of the world where it snows, cover them in that autumn period so that even if snow is sitting on top of the pile, it's sitting on top of the cover, and then the snow just slides off and you know, goes into the ground around your pile instead of destroying the quality of your pile.
Mm. Well, we are running out of time, so I think we will close off now. So Elaine, would you like to sort of sum up in a sort of a minute or two? And Tony, would you like to sum up in a minute or two what your final words are? So Elaine, go first if you don't mind.
So we've been working on these systems and how to practically apply this biological knowledge out there in the real world. And Tony given us some really good examples of how to do this with dairy systems. We've got a number of large acre, broad acre people that are being successful at this transition. It's just working with each and every grower with the particular kind of equipment you've got, the particular kinds of situations that you encounter. You know, we got to design that program for each part of each ground, each field that you're thinking about. It's usually not too different from anybody else, but you know, let's think things through before you just kind of blithely go out there. And remember, it's the biology that's important. It's not whether you're putting out organic matter or not. It's the biology in that organic matter. Over to you, Tony.
Yes, thanks, Elaine. Yes, well, we're really we've just got some very exciting things happening within the dairy industry, and I think we're actually changing the way that dairy farmers practice. I think if we can do a really good job this year, which I think we are, I toured around 10 farms yesterday just to have a look, see where they're at with their compost piles, and they're all coming along really nicely. So if we do a good job on 50 farms this year, I think we will have made a critical mass, and we're making some big inroads. And it's basically working with the soil food web system. We are putting a little bit of liquid nitrogen in the dead of winter just because the ground's so cold and we don't have a lot of biology working because these farmers haven't been doing it long enough. But, boy, are we changing the way that they're doing things, and are we changing their nitrogen use? Because we had a couple of farmers this year, it got too wet to go out with the liquid nitrogen and they missed that round and they didn't notice that they'd missed the round. And now they're sort of questioning how much nitrogen do they really need. They're getting so much more nutrient cycling happening into their soils. It's been a big game changer for the dairy farmers. So, and it's coming back to a system where there's very little nitrogen going into it now. And I think Elaine's going to put down the challenge to say, well, can you do it without nitrogen? So that's probably the next step for some of these guys. If we were able to do that, the amount of nutrients that these farmers are buying or commodities that these farmers are buying is almost insignificant, and it is absolutely amazing. They're getting two uses out of the nutrients that they're buying in their grain. So the phosphorus and potassium coming in grain or hay or silage, they're using for the cow, and then they're reusing it back on the pasture. And the drivers for using it is reduced because then they're pulling the phosphorus and potassium off the sand silts and clays, as Elaine's been preaching to us for 11 years, and it's only just starting to sink in now. But it's amazing. We've got examples on sandy soil where they really can't hold their potassium, and the Whiting's farm is an example of that with a light sandy soil. Hasn't put potassium on for 3 years, has not lost any potassium out of his soil. Where's it coming from? Well, it's quite obvious it's coming from the sand silts and clays, which Helen's been talking about. So it's really exciting that we are starting to access these nutrients, and we're not mining the soil. That's the thing that I find amazing. We're not mining the soil at all.
On that note, Tony, thank you very, very much. Elaine, have you got a parting word to say, or should I just close off?
I think just close off. I think Tony said it all.
Well, I'd like to, Dr. Elaine Ingham, I'd like to thank you very, very much for coming on this call. And Tony, we'd like to thank you very, very much, and hopefully, and I know you will expand your business into other areas of farming. So I'd like to thank both of you very, very much for coming on the line. But most importantly, I want to thank the farmers who have come on the line, and also want to thank the farmers who will be listening to this this CD when it's in the CD form, because change is imminent, and looking after the biology is imminent, and people like, well, Soil Food Web Institute, who are the world leaders in this area, are the one the people to take notice of. So it's goodbye from me. Elaine?
Well, goodbye, and thanks very much for inviting me to participate. Thank you.
Tony?
Thanks, Hugo. Thanks, Elaine. It's been very informative. I've learned a lot myself. It's great.
Fantastic. Well, goodbye.